This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of October 14th, 2019. I'm Mason King.
Some people love this idea, others not so much. The tide is turning for student athletes in California. In a few years, they will be able to start making money from their skills through sports agents and endorsement deals, much like their professional counterparts.
The question now is if California's new law will spark change across the country.
It's going to initiate dozens of other states to introduce similar legislation, and it's going to change college sports for the better by having now the interests, finally, of the athletes on par with the interests of the institutions.
On September 30th, the world of college sports was turned upside down. California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a law that allows college athletes to profit from the use of their name, image, or likeness. And the name of this law is the Fair Pay to Play Act. Newsom couched this as a corrective measure to help compensate college athletes who generate millions of dollars for their schools without being allowed to profit off of their own fame and expertise. Here's what Newsom said when he signed the law on LeBron James's show, The Shop, on HBO.
The gig's up. Billions and billions of dollars. 14 plus billion dollars goes to these universities, goes to these colleges, billion plus revenue to the NCAA themselves. And the actual product, the folks that are putting their lives on the line, putting everything on the line, are getting nothing. You can only imagine how they're responding to this notion of name, image, likeness, and the opportunity now to do what every other student in the university can legally do.
Now, you'll notice that he mentioned the NC2A there. That's obviously the NCAA, based here in Indianapolis, which is the governing body of collegiate sports. And we tend to talk about it sometimes like it's an independent organization, but it essentially represents all of the college athletic departments in the country. And it has hemmed very closely over many decades to the amateurism model, dictating that college athletes cannot be compensated for anything remotely related to their college careers. While right now this law only pertains to California, close to a dozen other states have either drafted or are considering similar legislation. So as they say, the ball is in the NCAA's court. It's faced with a national groundswell of sentiment against one of its key principles. So to help make sense of all this, we are joined in the studio by IBJ reporter Anthony Shutley, who has been covering the business of sports for more than two decades. Anthony, thank you for joining me.
Happy to be here.
Okay, so let's first make sure we understand the Fair Pay to Play Act. Now, what does it allow when it goes into effect in 2023? Like, if I'm the point guard for Pepperdine and I was recruited, but I didn't accept it, what does this mean I'll be able to do or get that I couldn't before?
So there's a term, an acronym, that people in sports and entertainment use, NIL, that stands for name, image, and likeness. But in its simplest terms, the law allows college athletes to profit from their name, image, and likeness. So what does that mean? It means a college athlete could do a TV ad. It means a college athlete could do any kind of advertisement. It means a college athlete could profit from its YouTube video. It could sell its autograph. It could run a camp or be involved in a camp where it's teaching other people to play its sport and profit from that. Those are some of the simplest and I think will be some of the most prolific examples of what this law allows. And remember, this law, very importantly, specifically prohibits the NCAA or its member organizations, i.e. conferences and schools, from barring athletes for accepting that kind of money, in this case, within the state of California.
You brought up the coaching example, and that was a bit of a revelation for me, because initially I was just thinking about, you know, guys that would do car dealership ads and get however much money because they were so well known. But if I play lacrosse, for example, or I row crew, you know, these are sports that are played by people with money. And if I am able to make money by being a coach, I mean, that could be a really significant income.
Youth sports and high school sports is booming and is a business. And these instructional camps are huge, and college athletes have been used for years by their own coaches and by their own schools to participate in these camps pro bono. So the demand is very big. The college athlete, in many respects, is more identifiable, is more relatable than the pro athlete. And, you know, a lot of parents would like their child to be taught or counseled or educated in sports by a collegiate athlete more so than a pro athlete. I mean, that's been the case for years. I mean, Andrew Luck was taking part in camps, you know, long before he was a counselor at Peyton Manning's camp, for example, when he was in college, and, you know, people like Damon Bailey as well. And now, at least in the state of California for the time being, they're going to allow to be paid for that service.
Now, I want to make sure folks understand that the law isn't asking the schools to pay the players. They aren't getting paid or wouldn't be getting paid by the schools to play or compensated based on how much money the school would earn from their names and likenesses. All this would come from outside the schools. It'd be people paying the athlete directly to provide some kind of service.
That's an important point. There are some very serious issues, legal issues, liability issues with student athletes or college students who are athletes for their schools and taking money from the schools. That makes them employees of the school. That's a whole issue that really a lot of people smartly don't want to open up. So the schools will lose nothing in terms of what goes to the athlete. Well, with this caveat, this very important caveat, from the school's standpoint and from the NCAA's standpoint, they're very concerned about sponsor money or alumni support going directly to the athletes now rather than to the school. But no, the schools are not paying the athlete. In fact, the California law notably prohibits schools from paying college athletes for their name, image, and likeness.
How many students are there, student athletes are there out there potentially that could benefit from this? I think I'd seen a figure like 500,000.
Yeah, hundreds of thousands. I mean, when you start talking about Division I, Division II, Division III, we could talk NAIA. So this is an important point you bring up, because a lot of people would argue that only less than 1% or fewer than 1% of college athletes are going to benefit from this thing. When I talked to David Ridpath, the president of one of the largest watchdog groups of college athletics, he had pointed out to me that his group feels that every athlete has value, that even the player for the smallest school in the smallest division on the end of the bench was in all likelihood a hero somewhere in his hometown and could potentially profit in some way, shape, or form from their name, image, and likeness. Fred Hoiberg, who is now a Big Ten college basketball coach, played at Iowa State, said he could have profited enormously in the town of Ames, Iowa, which was his hometown where he played college basketball.
Yeah, where he was known as the mayor.
That's
he was
right.
So popular.
He was known as the mayor. And Ridpath, I think, rightly pointed out that even Damon Bailey, who had literally no professional career, a little bit in the Continental Basketball Association, I think 1 year playing for the Pacers, which he never suited up, could have made potentially $400,000 to $500,000 easily, Ridpath thinks, during his four-year college career at Indiana University. So the fact that people think that this is just for the biggest names in college sports is a little bit of a misnomer. Maybe $10,000 or $20,000 isn't a big deal to some people, some athletic directors and college coaches who have seven-figure salaries. But to a student-athlete, to be able to make even $20,000 over the course of 4 years would go a long way toward helping with bills and maybe even setting them up in the first year or two out of college.
Okay, let me tell you my understanding of kind of how this plays out, and tell me if I'm wrong. Now, initially, I think there was some concern or some talk that California schools could be exempted from NCAA competition somehow or be punished somehow. But my understanding is that there are enough states now headed in this direction that there will be a critical mass of schools with players that could do this. So the NCAA is going to have to address this or respond to this somehow with a universal policy.
The NCAA has an enormous problem that they're facing right now. And really, they're facing that problem with a stiff neck at the moment and are showing some unwillingness to change. But here's the problem. A couple of points. In California, this thing passed the California State Assembly by a vote of 72-0. Let that sink in for a second. Republicans and Democrats can't agree on hardly anything, but they all came together to vote unanimously for this measure. Take a look at the other states that are considering this, very seriously considering this. They are divergent. We're talking about not only California, New York, Kentucky, South Carolina. I mean, these are divergent states, North Carolina, that are considering this. And also consider the fact that there are a dozen bills out there from 11 states right now, and they're split. Some are authored by Republicans, some are authored by Democrats. So in a time where political operatives can't agree on anything, apparently they can agree on this issue.
That's really fascinating. Why is that?
This notion of amateurism is just outdated. You know, we had this same argument in the late 1970s and early 1980s about Olympic athletes. And every Olympic governing body, some of which are located right here in Indianapolis, as well as the USOC, came out in hard opposition of Olympic athletes, saying, you know, it'll destroy the notion of amateurism. You know, it will take money away from the governing bodies. Well, here's what it did. It proved that nobody cares about that notion of amateurism. They care about competition. And secondly, instead of hurting Olympic sports, it actually increased or raised the profile of Olympic sports by raising the profile of these athletes. I think that's exactly what will happen here. And I think in a decade, we're going to be talking about this in very antiquated terms.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. We'll be right back with the IBJ podcast.
The IBJ podcast is sponsored by Krieg DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Krieg DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Krieg DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.kriegdevault.com.
Okay, we're back with the IBJ podcast. We're talking with IBJ reporter Anthony Shutley about California's new Fair Pay to Play Act and its possible ramifications. So do we have any indication now of what the NCAA is thinking about this?
The NCAA has really been oppositional to this. They have recruited the Pac-12 to be oppositional. USC, UCLA has been oppositional to this. They have sent very terse letters to the governor of California. They've started to soften just a little bit. And in fact, their last letter sent to the governor and California state lawmakers indicated that they now recognize that change is needed. So they are supposed to come out with findings of a study group that they convened in May. They're supposed to come out with findings of that study group in late October. Now, state lawmakers and federal lawmakers, and it is important to know that Representative Anthony Gonzalez, Republican from Ohio, some people may remember that name. Anthony Gonzalez is a former wide receiver for Ohio State and also was a former wide receiver for the Indianapolis Colts. He is interested in getting involved with a bill on the federal level. Another Republican from North Carolina is interested in authoring that bill. So, you know, the NCAA may be doing this at the point of a bayonet because, you know, the tide is really shifting, not only on state to state, but also national. Now, the NCAA has told lawmakers, or I shouldn't say told, at this point it's an ask, to back off and let the NCAA take a lead. They smartly want to make a national policy. There's no rubric where a state-by-state patchwork of laws and legislation is going to work very well. So I think that they are seriously thinking about making some kind of a change. My guess would be just enough of a change to placate lawmakers, state and federal. But I think they are feeling like their back's up against the wall. They're still, Mark Emmert, the president of the NCAA, is still very strongly against this. Some athletic directors I tried to speak with and coaches would not speak on this. But the cracks are starting to appear. At Big Ten Media Day, we saw Richard Pitino, coach of Minnesota, come out in favor of this. Again, we saw Fred Hoiberg, who was a coach in the league, come out in favor of this. The University of Connecticut football coach came out strongly for this. And as recently as last week, we saw Duke University basketball coach Mike Krzyzewski come out in favor of this. So I think the NCAA has got their hands full. But so far, I haven't been able to find an athletic director recently. Now, Mike Bobinski at Purdue told me that he favors athletes being able to profit from their name, image, and likeness in 2017. Jack Swarbrick, the athletic director at the University of Notre Dame, had indicated to me that he would be willing to have this conversation all the way back in 2015. But when I tried this week to talk to athletic directors, they're still very much not in a position or not wanting to take a position of saying anything against the NCAA or that the NCAA would want them to say.
Yeah, Krzyzewski's comments were really I don't know if surprising is the best word, but I mean, here's a guy who is as, you know, successful and revered as an NCAA establishment figure could be. And I think he came out basically and said, you know, we need to grow up and we need to realize, you know, what's happening on a national level, and we need to address compensation in a very full and comprehensive way. Do you think that came as a surprise to the NCAA? Does that light a fire under them?
I'm sure it made executives in the NCAA's offices here in Indianapolis angry. I don't know how surprising it was. It wasn't surprising to me from this standpoint. College coaches have a lot of pressure on themselves to kind of police this kind of money. I think in some ways, if you open this up, it takes some pressure off of the coaches and the compliance offices in some ways. Now, this is still going to require some compliance. David Ridpath with the Drake Group pointed out to me that you can't have college athletes selling their autograph to alumni for $5 million. That's a problem, right? Or you know, I'm being facetious, the $5 million, but even $10,000, right? It has to be fair market value. So there's going to need to be some compliance. All of this spending is going to have to be reported to the schools, or all of this income, as it were, is going to have to be reported to the schools, the conferences, and the NCAA. You're still going to have to police it. So the policing issue doesn't go away, but many people think that the resources for that kind of policing are in place with the current compliance. So there's fear. There's fear that athletes will magnate toward schools and bigger markets where they can make more money off their name, image, and likeness. But I doubt very seriously an athlete's going to enroll in Rutgers University so they can have access to the New York City market if they have scholarships from Michigan or Ohio State or a big school like that. So,
They're going to probably need an agent, which they would not be able to do under this law, the California law.
So that's in the law, and I'll be honest with you. I'm not 100% sure how that part of it works. They are allowed, according to the state law in California, to have an agent to handle these commercial deals. Now, does that also mean that they could have an agent to help, that same agent could help them negotiate, you know, with professional teams, be they in Europe or in the U.S., what that agent can do and can't do? That to me is a little less clear.
Yeah, and let me back up for a second to one of these arguments against allowing athletes to be compensated for commercial activity. Now, here's one that was discussed on ESPN's College Football Live. And the scenario is that school boosters and donors could set up deals with companies in the local market to pay top athletes through that company for potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars, say for like a car commercial. You know, a booster could, you know, pay whatever, Bill Burns Ford, $300,000. So that guy could turn around and pay somebody else $300,000 to be in a commercial. Let's hear what they said on the show.
Now, Joey, under this new rule, what happens is, okay, highest bidder. What do you have for me? I can come. I'll be the face of your car dealership. 150 G's. I'm the face of it. You can use me and you can market, you can advertise. So, I mean, that's what it's going to be. It's going to be people basically bidding for your services, and it's going to be all out warfare. And that's the part that needs to be ironed out over the next several years and figured out.
So is that a legitimate argument?
As a business writer, you know, I'm really all for the free enterprise supply and demand market. It's kind of like the nation needs to have an examination of conscience. It's people ask themselves, what's the problem with these players bringing in as much money as they can by whatever means? I mean, not illicit means, right? But to me, it's kind of a free market and supply and demand issue. Now, the Drake Group would argue that we need to have fair market value. I think that's a little bit of a tricky thing to define. I think that all that's being redefined. And I think if you open up this box, none of this is defined. Fair market value. What's the fair market value? Well, there is no market for these guys. So what's a fair market? For all I know, a company might place a higher value on a college athlete for whatever reason than they do on an NBA athlete or an NFL athlete or an Olympic athlete. I don't know. Nor am I sure what the hang-up is exactly with allowing a booster to give an athlete whatever money he wants. Now, I know behind closed doors what the NCAA would say. It looks unseemly. It doesn't look right. It doesn't feel right. And it's gonna hurt our image, and it's gonna hurt our TV and our ticket revenue. The school's perspective, they're worried about money walking out the door going directly to an athlete.
What just occurred to me is that this might actually be a way to convince some athletes to stay in college longer. I mean, if they're going to the pros as quickly as they can because they need the paycheck, or they feel like, you know, they need to support their families. You know, if they're talented enough, I mean, this could be a way to stay in college.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. And I really think the issue of education and somebody making money is totally separate. For any other student, being in college and making money are totally separate issues.
Well, let me bring up another argument. This one kind of has some traction with me. Let's say I'm a player for Butler. I'm a freshman, and I'm thinking, you know, Butler's nice, but I got to get out of here. You know, I want to make the big bucks. So instead of being, you know, paid by, you know, Indianapolis car dealerships, I get paid by a tri-state area dealership. So I try to go on a scoring binge the first four games of the season. I mean, I just light it up as much as they'll let me. And then, you know, once the phone starts ringing, I go, I'm going to transfer. So what does that do to the quality of the college game if everybody is basically auditioning for a better deal?
Well, that's an interesting argument, because for years and years and years, little known fact, college athletes did not get four-year commitments from their universities. And how many guys from, I'm going to pick on the IU basketball team for a second because I'm an IU graduate, from the IU basketball team under Tom Crean, the coach, or whoever, have just vanished? Well, a lot of those guys, their scholarships were revoked or they were pushed out of the nest, and IU's certainly not the only one. Now, they've moved toward four-year scholarships and four-year commitments. So the schools, you know, traditionally have not made four-year commitments to the athletes, but we want to turn around and say, well, the athletes need to make four-year commitments to the schools. I'm not sure how equitable that is, and I don't know how fair it is to try to control that. And the NCAA has tried to control that transfer issue. And, you know, maybe it would be a little bit of anarchy if you just let people willy-nilly transfer all over the place. But I'm not sure that that would be as big a problem as people might tend to believe.
Now, let's stay in Indiana for a second. Let's look at the legislature. Is there any indication that our lawmakers are interested in having this conversation or passing a kind of California-style law?
There is a big indication and a big track record of state lawmakers working with the NCAA and working hard to please the NCAA. And I'm not criticizing them for that. The NCAA has done a lot for the city of Indianapolis and the state of Indiana. It's one of the crown jewels of our, you know, sports landscape. I don't expect our state lawmakers to pick this up. I did have one, Greg Porter, who represents an area, the Old North Side and some of that area around there, who said he would be willing to have the conversation. And he thinks, in fact, that there should be a thorough conversation. I don't think that's going to be a widely held view. This is not an issue that the citizenry is jumping up and down for, screaming that the state legislators need to pick up and deal with. So for this to happen, a fairly large group of state lawmakers is going to have to come together and say, hey, let's all, you know, willingly pick up this controversial hot potato that one of our biggest citizens here in the NCAA strongly opposes. Let's pick that up and talk about passing that. So I don't think that's going to happen. But we'll see.
Yeah, that's got study session written all over it.
Yeah.
So what is the next thing that could happen or will happen?
So at the end of this month, the NCAA study group, which was convened in May by NCAA President Mark Emmert and the 22-member Board of Governors, which is the Board of Governors, essentially athletic directors and university presidents, that study group for the NCAA is supposed to come out with its findings by the end of this month. Now, it's important to note that even the California state lawmakers, but other state lawmakers have said that if the NCAA comes back with substantive changes, that they would consider amending their law or amending a bill that's not yet a law in other states' cases. So I think at heart, the lawmakers want to give the NCAA a chance to do what they feel is the right thing to do.
All right. Well, let's wait till the end of the month to see what happens. My thanks again to Anthony. If you check out the latest issue of IBJ, Anthony has a deep dive into the subject and examines how views on athlete compensation are quickly shifting. And there are a couple of other stories I want to bring to your attention. IBJ's Mickey Shuey has an in-depth accounting of all 18 new hotels that have been proposed for downtown Indianapolis. There's an unprecedented number of rooms in the pipeline, but experts don't expect all of these hotels to make it to opening day. And Susan Orr explores complaints against a local investment firm from clients who say brokers steered them into unsuitable investments. Again, you can read all of these stories in the copy of IBJ that you, of course, have delivered to your home or office, or you can read them online at ibj.com. And remember, to get full and unfettered access to all of IBJ's award-winning business content, just hit the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King, and we'll be back again next week.